I would not paint a picture. I'd rather be the one. It's bright impossibility to dwell delicious on. And wonder how the fingers feel whose rare celestial stir evokes so sweet a torment, such sumptuous despair. I would not talk like cornets. I'd rather be the one raised softly to horizons, the ceilings, and out and easy on. Through villages of ether, myself upborne, upheld, sustained, endued balloon by but a lip of metal, the pier to my pontoon. Nor would I be a poet. It's finer, own the ear. Enamored, impotent, content, the license to revere. A luxury, privilege so awful, what would the dower be? Had I the art to stun myself with bolts of melody?
This is The Slave Is Gone, the show that talks back to Apple TV's Dickinson.
I'm Jericho Brown.
And I'm Brianne Janae, but you can call me Breezy.
We explore what's historically true, what's emotionally true, what works for us,
and what doesn't, in the Apple TV series about Emily Dickinson.
And because we're poets who are fascinated by Dickinson's verse, we always bring it back to the poetry. Hey, Breezy.
Hey, Jericho.
Are you ready to talk about Dickinson and everything going on in this episode? Mm-hmm. There's sickness and death, the romance of the written word, the links poets will go to get some space to write. Are you ready?
Yep. And I am looking forward to exploring all of it with our special guest, Amber Flame.
And our rogue scholar, Aoife Murray.
So let's get into it. Dickinson, Season 1, Episode 6, A Brief But Patient Illness. Emily decides she wants to stay in her room all day and write poetry, so she pretends to be terribly sick.
Her parents think she's on her deathbed and start confessing things to her. Her mother admits she didn't want children. Her father reveals he had sex with a maid while he was a student at Yale, when he and her mother were already engaged.
Later, Emily sneaks out of her bedroom to find a book in the library and meets her father's new law clerk, Ben Newton, who it turns out is also a lover of poetry.
The next morning, Emily is fully and apparently miraculously recovered, and she gives the poem she's been working on to Ben, who loves it, of course.
Sue, her brother's fiancé and Emily's lover, returns from Boston because she heard Emily might die. When Emily talks with Sue, she tells her to marry Austin.
While all this is going on, Emily's sister Lavinia is having an artist paint her portrait. She doesn't like how it turns out and tries doing a nude self-portrait instead. So for me, this episode really brought up these two sides of life that we've been thinking about, and mm-hmm. that is, what does it mean to be social, and what does it mean to be isolated, particularly when you're a poet? What does it mean to have and need solitude, and what does it mean to have and need real life experiences about which to write? For instance, falling in love. What's really interesting to me about this episode is that while Emily might be right that she needs to have to lie in order to get her poems done, falling in love does not allow you to keep up with that lie. It can support or get in the way of getting your poems done. But when you fall in love, you really want to do whatever it takes to stay in love. Breezy.
I mean, I love this episode because I feel like who among us hasn't played hooky to do a little reading, a little writing, you know? And you know, it's interesting because she, as you mentioned, she had to lie to get that privacy, lie to get that time on her own. It's interesting, like, what a privilege it is to have. It is, I think, in our modern context, to have space of one's own. I think, you know, in the past, people were, I don't know, I think there were less single women sort of having their own space. Families were bigger, probably, you know, like, and I don't know, Emily seems like this moment, it seems like a real privilege that she gets this space to herself. And I don't blame her for fighting for it, you know, and for lying to get in. And, but it's interesting because she hurts so many, or not hurts, but she puts everybody in their feelings in order to get this time to herself. What's the most you've had to do, Jericho, to get some time to yourself? Right.
I don't know. I mean, I think more than I'll steal time from other responsibilities, I end up stealing time from myself, which is to say I steal time from my own sleep. I think most of my writing has really been done because I'm willing myself awake, or I can't sleep because I got to get this line right. You know, I got to get this comma. Is this really a comma, or maybe this is an M dash? You know, I can spend hours where I should be resting, scratching my head and poring over a computer screen.
See, I like to get my writing done on other people's time. I think that's the best thing about cell phones these days, is that you can be in the middle of whatever and then pull up your phone and be like, oh, actually, this is what that line needed, you know, or this is what that stanza needed. And just that ability to be doing it throughout your day, you know, and when I used to teach college writing, not a mentor and a counselor for college students, I would love the days when nobody came to get counsel, because I would be sitting there writing poems on the school's dime. You know, thank you to Bunker Hill Community College for their contribution to my work. I don't blame her for doing what she got to do.
Yeah, I don't either, especially in that house.
Yeah, especially in that house. It makes me think about that Virginia Woolf essay, A Room of One's Own, where she talks about how important it is for women writers in particular to have space of their own if they're going to be allowed to write. I think she says they need a lock, a door with a lock and a key. Because otherwise, you know, everybody is going to be bothering you, which we see with Emily. You know, she is able to get away and to have her own space, but she's constantly being interrupted by her family, by her parents, by her brother, who come not necessarily to tend to her, but to unburden themselves of their own, of whatever is heavy on their spirit at that time. I don't know. It makes me think about our special guest, Amber Flame.
Amber Flame is a really, truly interdisciplinary creative.
Yes, she
She's published two collections of poetry, Ordinary Cruelty and the forthcoming Apocrypha.
Flame was recently named program director for Hedgebrook on Puget Sound in Washington State, which is all about supporting visionary women writers. Welcome, Flame.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
Thank you for being here. You want to tell us a little bit about why it's important to have that lock and key?
Y'all brought me around because I was really not Team Emily coming into this, listening to y'all talk. And I was like, oh, right. The arrogance of a writer, the arrogance of a creative, the shucking of your role in a family, in a community, in sacrifice of your art, in sacrifice of the thing that haunts you that you must do. Yeah, I was kind of like, are we going to talk about how she, like, you said she didn't harm anybody, but I would argue that she did. She was quite harmful.
Yeah.
But as you continued, I was like, you're right. There needs to be space. And if you do not, you know, elbow and carve and insist upon that space, then you sacrifice yourself. And I realized I've been talking about resentment a lot and how I'm learning when I get resentful about somebody else having something, it's often because I'm offering them what I'm not offering myself.
Yeah, say that.
which is really easy to do at Hedgebrook. Hedgebrook is a magical place. And I tried really, really hard to get there as a writer myself. And went in 2017 as a writer, and coming back as a full-time staff member means that Hedgebrook is no longer my retreat. You know, it's always work. Even when it's wonderful and beautiful and great and glorious and joyous work, I'm on the other side of what it takes to provide that space, what it takes to, and it does take work. It does take sacrifice. Somebody has to be willing to do the dishes and make the food and tend the garden and clean the bed and all of those things. And the luxury of allowing that for yourself is exactly the mission, right? It's to amplify women identified writers' voices by providing radical hospitality, a space to write. And you get this cottage of your own, not just a room of your own, but a cottage of your own in the woods with nothing on you but to go and collect your meal and maybe sit in communication, in conversation with the writers you're there with. Right. I'm like, oh, my resentment towards Emily Dickinson in this somewhat fictional representation of how she was as kind of a bratty young woman is because I want to be that bratty and be like, no, I shall not rise from my bed today.
Yes.
I'm haunted by my words and I must capture them.
Yes.
Also, challenge accepted. A poem has to blow, like take the top of my head off.
Yes.
No pressure.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I was going to say, I feel like this is one of the most romantic episodes that we've gotten so far, because they're literally trading poetry back and forth, Emily and Ben, and sort of and falling in love and like, who knows, over words.
A dirge is a different kind of love song. You better go in, poet. Yes. Come on. Thrilled my heart.
What are the love poems, or what kind of poems do you use, Flame, to woo a boo?
Come to on, woo a boo.
To woo a boo. Are you reading poems to your boos? And if not, you should be.
Am I having boos? Can we back up to a more existential crisis that's happening? If I were, so my dream, actually, I'm gonna hype my own work for a minute. I wrote this book, Apocrypha. It's a love story. It's a non-gendered love story between a beloved and their lover. And I use contrapuntal poetry like call and response. And so my dream is that lovers of all types and of all stripes will read these poems to each other, will be in voice together.
You sort of meant it as a spell casted so that other people could fall in love. Do you think that spell could also lead to you falling in love? Do you think we can write ourselves into an experience?
So I must have misspoke. I'm an Aries. I wrote it so that I could fall in love. Oh, okay. I was manifesting for me. I just imagined something larger for the work itself. And I do. It's funny that you asked that way, Jericho, because I realize that the two characters are the two parts of me. Mm-hmm. So it is to fall in love myself and to fall in love with myself and to be okay with both the part of me that longs for flight and freedom and the part of me that wants to root and nest at home. So yes, and absolutely, this better bring me something. You know what I'm saying? Like, why be a poet if I can't get some attention at least?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
The longing for audience that Emily has is also really, really struck me. Can you write and be satisfied with your own words in silence without sharing, without an audience?
No, that whole idea just stresses me out. Like, even if it's an audience of one, which is why I think, you know, this episode is so romantic, because at the end she shares that poem with Ben. You know, I think you don't need like a whole bunch of people, but I swear you need at least one. Mm. At least one. So you feel seen. Like, otherwise, you know, I feel like Lavinia, who said, you know, like, if this painting doesn't happen, I would disappear. If I write these poems and nobody, you know, I don't need the whole world, you know, but like a friend, you know, I call Flame all the time and be like, I have a poem. Are you ready to hear it? Because I need that. Mm-hmm. You know, I need that personal party to say, yes,
Well, I don't know if Dickinson ever thought of her poems as incantations or spells, but I love thinking about poetry that way. And so I'm glad that you brought that to us, Flame. It's one of my favorite ways to think about poetry. And I do think it's true about poems, right? We know that there are power in words. And so when I organize these words in this certain perfect way, yes, there should be something so powerful that it makes a real change in the natural realm. Like I have written this incantation such that it might be chanted when the need arises. So I don't think, I think poems need an ear. And it's also interesting because people's love of Dickinson, I think, is always colored by this idea that she did not have that need, when in actuality she did. And definitely on this show, she does.
I mean, speaking of that need to be seen, Lavinia, this whole episode, has been trying to be seen, trying to be remembered, and try to be seen and remembered beautifully. She wants to get a portrait done of herself, and in the end winds up doing her own self-portrait in nude.
Mm-hmm.
Which,
as it should be.
As it should be.
Oh, poor baby Lavinia. We just have a moment. She just, bless her heart. You know, she's just trying out here to shine. And it's rough. It's rough the way that she is dismissed so easily.
Mm-hmm.
It's certainly, and the actress playing Lavinia, I'm just, the flinches, I think, of it is just so, feels so real. I just want her to wind up okay, you know? Mm-hmm. I just want her to be all right.
Well, I do love what the show is doing for its younger or young guest viewers in this moment with Lavinia. I imagine that part of what we're supposed to believe just looking at the actress playing Lavinia is that she's plenty a good looking woman, right? Mm, she's pretty, mm-hmm. right? When she looks at that portrait and she sees herself as she is, in spite of the fact that all we see is yet another picture of the person we've been walking around, that's, you know, the person we've been watching on camera, she doesn't see that beauty that we assume is necessary to be on camera at all, which seems to me a really lovely message for so many young people really disturbed that maybe they are not pretty or pretty enough. Certainly, I would like to believe that some of those young people think, oh, maybe that's what I'm going through. Maybe I don't understand that I'm okay just the way I am. It is interesting to me that triggers in Lavinia these drawings. And I wanted to ask Aoife about these drawings. We see if our rogue scholar will join us. Are you here with us, Aoife?
I am. Happy
to be here.
Can you tell
us more about these drawings? Are these completely made up by this show? Or was Lavinia a visual artist?
As far as we know, she wasn't a visual artist.
Wow.
But I think that those two girls, when they were teens and in their early 20s, would have been the queens of TikTok.
Uh-huh.
They were into posing, and they were into their presentation and the dramatic swirls. And Lavinia always had a frock off the shoulder, if she could get away with it. So these girls were into their dramatic flourishes. And interestingly, even though Lavinia wasn't a visual artist, appearances were important. And years after her sister died, when the poems are like sending shockwaves around the world, Vinia's the force behind getting her sister's daguerreotype redone. Kind of feminized. So remember, the famous daguerreotype of Dickinson is taken when she's 16, and it's like her hair's part in the middle, it's pulled back, sort of severe looking. And the family hated that daguerreotype. And so when, you know, years later, right, when the poems are like selling like hotcakes, Vinnie's the force behind getting this curly hair. She said, well, this is how she looked as an adult. This is how she looked to us. So she got this drawing done, or the daguerreotype kind of refashioned with curls and ruffs. And she really looks very femme. That was Lavinia.
Can you say more about what a daguerreotype is, just so our audience can have
it? That's a really good, okay, early photography. And it was long exposure. So you had to sit for a really long time. It's like being filmed, except that you can't move, right? Mm. I mean, it's that long of a sit. And so actually in Dickinson's famous daguerreotype, there's actually a little bit of blur, I think, maybe to her hand or something in that photograph, because you had to sit so long. Kids, you can't do daguerreotypes of kids because they can't sit still long enough. Mm-hmm. So, and it was even hard for a 16-year-old. Yeah, so it's early, early, early photography. And that one that was done of Dickinson was 1847.
It's interesting you would bring this up about photography, because in the show, they are interested in showing her desperate to get a painting made of herself. But in actuality, maybe a young person at that time would be more desperate to have a photo done of themselves, would be my first question. And then my second question is, when you talk about the daguerreotype in particular, and I'm not sure how fast the technology for photographs goes, but it seems when I see a picture of any picture of Frederick Douglass is much better than any picture I see on Instagram today. Right? Like he cannot be bothered. Like, why am I wearing clothes? Do you know? he's like mint for photographs. So how is it that, you know, this description of the daguerreotype, if you have it, looks one way in my memory of Emily Dickinson of the daguerreotype, but in the same period, Frederick Douglass is taking these, what seem to me very contemporary looking pictures.
Isn't he like the most photographed person ever?
I think he was the most photographed person of the period somehow. I think
he had practice. No, but just like those gram models.
It's really interesting what you say. I mean, why didn't she get a daguerreotype? But remember, she's really fighting with that portrait paint. Well, first of all, it seems to be fashionable to get yourself painted. Mm-hmm. So she's kind of going with the flow. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she's trying to keep up with Jane and all the other fashion trendsetters. But the other thing is, she's really struggling with that guy around. She wants to look more beautiful. And I think there's some way that she thinks she can control in a way that she can't with photography, with daguerreotype or wherever photography is, that she can control. And then he really, in one of the many put downs of Lavinia, he goes, I paint truth.
I mean, and it's like she was looking for a filter. The right. Yeah, an Instagram filter.
Absolutely. You know, you said that's TikTok star. Needed. That's it. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
She's like, give me the filter, the like, you know, the Nashville filter, you know, like give me something that looks a little softer around the edges.
But I love about the show that she takes her power back at the end and does her own portrait. And that she does a portrait nude, you know, like what a power move.
Yeah.
To say, I'm going to own my body and the presentation of my body.
And I'm so glad too, because nobody was giving it up for her. Like her mother constantly would be like, well, why you? Why would anybody pick you? Why would anybody kidnap you? Like there's all this seated throughout. She's also simple. She just wants to be pretty and wanted and seen. And so I do love that she sees herself at the end.
Thanks to Smith College for its sponsorship of The Slave Is Gone.
Smith first opened its doors to students in 1871, when Emily Dickinson was still living and writing up the road in Amherst.
And just like no one at that time would have imagined that Emily Dickinson's poems would be read around the world, they'd probably also be surprised by the impact this women's college continues to have more than 150 years later.
Smith's faculty, students, and community of alums are driving change in the world, making knowledge a force for good.
Whether you're a parent, a prospective student, an academic professional, or someone who counts yourself as part of the Smith community, learn about Smith now at smith.edu. Blame, you said earlier that you felt like we changed your mind about Dickinson. We think of Dickinson, as she is given to us in this show, as a bit of a brat as well. So we don't want to completely change your mind. Were there particular things or specific things that you thought, or ways people individually or as a whole had been wronged? Or do you think pretending you're sick is just wrong?
Oh, no, I don't think that's wrong. Like, as Breezy said, everybody's played hooky some way. Sue, she is particularly cruel and unthinking to this person that she claims to love. Mm-hmm. And when she came back and she was like, I thought you were dying. Everybody has died. Like, Emily can't keep anybody else's concerns in her head for much time at all. She is absolutely 100% preoccupied with her own thoughts. Mm-hmm. And I think even with Ben, the reason why Ben is interesting to her is because Ben is leaning in to her thoughts and seems to be some kind of equal who will meet her there. But her treatment of Sue, Breezy, you were saying earlier about needing witness or like needing your poems to be heard. And I think what I love about Sue is that Sue would receive and not respond, and that there's no way to better drive a poet nuts than to be like, that's nice. Or, you know, well, thank you. I wrote this poem for you. I wrote this beautiful, I pressed this flower for you. And it's just like silence. Like, I mean, I love it. I love it. And I think it was particularly cruel to not think of the impact it would have on Sue to tell her that she was dying.
I mean, and not only that, as soon as Sue gets back, she tells her that she should marry Austin.
She sure did.
You know, Sue was like, I came back for you because I thought you were dying. And she's like, yeah, but my brother loves you.
I'm otherwise occupied. I have something else. That's why.
Because I mean, I'm not mad at that. You know,
I'm not mad either. I'm glad for it, but
once upon a time, an 18-year-old Breezy desperately wanted to meet a man in a book store amongst the shelves, you know, and read poetry to each other. And then I realized I was gay.
The show would like for us to believe that Emily's brother's confessions about Sue while Emily is supposedly sick, that is really why she's willing to let Sue go. And the fact that Emily has a new boyfriend helps support that. Obviously, it makes it all the easier. My only trouble with any of it was just, and I, coming out of Pride Month, I wanted to hear anybody say, oh, it was just a phase.
That part.
As opposed to having an opportunity toward queerness, which, by the way, includes bisexuality, it seems that this show is interested in pushing us toward this idea that, oh, when you're, 14, 15, you might be a girl messing around with another girl, but, you'll meet a guy.
Which is especially when it was doing such a great job juxtaposing the mother and her lack of choice, her sense of like, this was the path that was laid out for me, whether I liked it or not, with Emily's choices that she's now making and through her privilege and through her father's support, his very, very twisted support. So yes, I also was like, no, you did not unqueer the queer love story of this.
Yeah.
But also I have hope, because the previous episode, of course, has Austin leaning into this whole Desdemona character. And I was like, there's something here. There's something very simpatico about their personalities that are almost like two sides of the. And I saw that more. I saw that she recognized in Austin this sort of befuddled enchantment with Sue, because Sue wouldn't give it up. Sue is such a closed mystery. And when she does reveal something, she's going through something that the rest of them just simply are not. And they do not understand, and they cannot set aside their own personal experience to get to it, to get to like what it would mean to lose your family. And she says, I would starve if I don't do something. I'm going to starve. And Emily just kind of like doop-de-doo dances right past these kind of moments that Sue is having. So I hope that there is queerness woven through Austin and Sue's experience. And And, you know, if they in the same house, I just don't believe that this is over yet.
Yeah, I don't think so either. Flame, you mentioned just now what Emily's mother admits to her when Emily is playing sick is how ultimately something Emily, if she thought about it, already knows that the mother never had any control, even over the fact of having children, that that in many ways her body was never her own. Or was controlled, it seems, by others, including her husband or her parents. So I wanted to ask Aoife this question. If you do not want to have a child and you are a woman and it is 1860, what do you do? 1855, what do?
You call the midwife and you say, I need to bring on my menses. Abortions were legal. So it was kind of a non-issue, although it was changing. It starts to change in the 19th century, but
I need to bring on my menses. That's all.
On the menses and the midwife, right? Because it's kind of a woman-controlled operation here, and you know, it hasn't kind of been medicalized with doctors who are male yet. And the midwife would, it was not an issue. But it starts to become an issue in the 19th century because suddenly Catholics are pouring in from famine Ireland, and they, at 24 weeks, they're not supposed to do abortions after 24 weeks, according to the Pope. So suddenly the white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, the Irish coming in, are not going to really be doing abortions, and they feared being overrun. And then in the 1880s, you start having the French Canadians coming in, they're Catholic. And then you also are getting the Southern Europeans, they're Catholic. And in 1869, the Pope says, sorry, but you can't do abortions at any time. So it's not just at the quickening, which is almost 24 weeks, but from the minute you have sex and you've conceived, you will be excommunicated. So suddenly the white Anglo-Saxon Protestant men want their women to start popping out babies. So what easier way to do that but make abortion illegal?
So what you're saying is that whole replacement theory hoo-ha that's going on with white men for being worried that they're being replaced has been going on for since we got here, essentially.
You got it.
Since Catholics were not considered white at first, before they bought their whiteness.
Whiteness is a trip.
Is it that abortion was legal, or that abortion was not at all thought of as something to put on the legal books or to make law or not law? It was assumed that that was your private business.
I'm not an expert in all of this history, but my understanding is that it was what you're saying, a private issue.
So men, seeing the number of Catholics, Protestant men want more children to keep up with the numbers is what you're telling me.
Yeah.
And before that, they didn't want to hear anything about what was happening down there. So that was women's business.
Well, I think there's a lot of different things probably happening at the same time. Like, you're starting to have medicine is changing and the role of doctors. I mean, there's many, many different things changing, and some of it driven by the war. A lot of folks, and even a lot of medical doctors, really relied on herbs and indigenous ways and home practices, you know, some of those. But the wars change things, and suddenly medicine sort of takes this leap forward, because suddenly you have an incredible amount of injuries, illnesses. So there's a lot of different things kind of happening at the same time, including 3 million people getting freed, and suddenly what happens in the country as people start moving around and gravitate. I mean, there's so much change happening in the 1850s and 1860s, 1870s, 1880s. I mean, the whole place is really, it's mobile.
I just wish things could be about what they're about, and that people could stop attaching moral and even biblical bullshit I mean, you know what I mean? Like, I actually kind of low key, no shade, get it, right? That, you know, because it sounds familiar to me. It sounds like the Black Arts Movement, right? Have these babies so we can have soldiers to start the revolution, right? So I get the idea, but the thing should be about the thing. Do y'all know what I mean? Like, oh, we lost 400,000 sons in the Civil War. Maybe let's replenish before we go back to abortions. You know, I sort of get that. Do you know what I mean? Like, I sort of actually get that as a talking point, which, you know, you can go back and forth about. That actually gives me something to go back and forth about, to be honest with you. But like suddenly just telling me that this is about right and wrong or Jesus, then I don't have anything to talk to you about if it's my body. Do you know what I'm saying?
But people are sorry. People don't want that back and forth. They want to use their religious moral authority to crush even, you know, the idea of women having their own rights and their own control.
Yeah, it's not a conversation.
But so many people's ideas end up being lies. That's what really drives me crazy about it.
Yeah.
Maybe we should talk about happier things. Let's talk about this fine man that Emily Dickinson is dating. He kind of fine. Maybe y'all don't like him.
I mean, no, I like him. I like him. He throws rocks outside her window, which is just like
sweet. It's so
they meet each other under the moonlight to read poetry to each other by the water. I'm here for him. I think.
Yeah, he had me as soon as he finished, you know, as soon as he quoted a line that she knew, I was like, okay, we're in this guy 100%. I was actually hoping he was married, frankly, so that it could just be one of those unrequited situations.
Unrequited?
Yes, the tension was great. It was delicious when she was like, does he like it? Does he not? Of course, she's more interested in how he feels about her thoughts and her poetry.
Aoife, who is this guy? Is he real?
He is so real.
Oh, tell us more about him. We are so happy.
He is so real. He introduces her to Emerson. So he is 9 years older than her in real life. He really is her father's law clerk. And it kind of ends up as a bit of a mentor and is sometimes associated as a love interest. I mean, you know, some people think that. But when he gives her an historical novel by Lydia Maria Child, and she comes back to him and she says, so this is a book. And there are more of them. I mean, she is just like completely plotched, excited. So he is definitely, I mean, okay, she's a saposexual. She is turned on by brains. So there's a lot of overlap with like people who are sort of somewhat mentors but they connect over writing. So there's Ben, George Gould. There possibly was an engagement for a while.
Oh.
Ben Newton is sometimes thought of as a love interest, Kate Anton. Obviously Sue Dickinson, because that's the big thing here. Then later in life, Otis Lord, whom I think she would have married at, you know, when she's 50 or something. But she's really, really turned on by brains.
I mean, who doesn't love a boo who can introduce you to a new poet?
Totally. But then we have her kind of opposite, her sister, who is a pleasure seeking social animal. That is, she's human. And not to say Dickinson's not, but I guess what I'm saying is she's kind of typical. I mean, we are wired. We're wired for sex. We're wired for hookups. I mean, that's kind of how we're made.
Well, and I know Vinny, I am.
And Vinny is like, okay, so I have to tell you, there is a diary that Vinny kept when she was 17, turning 18, 1851. And it is so chock full of life. I mean, this will not surprise you. At one point she said, ironing again, sad. But the other thing that's going on in this diary is it was like a revolving boy door. She'd have one boy coming in the front gate while another one escaped out the back door.
Yes.
I mean, this girl was going, I'm telling you. So you got these two really interesting, right, examples, these two sisters. They love each other, but they're really wired differently.
I love that about Lavinia.
I'm loving that about Lavinia. Thank you for that, because I feel a lot better about her getting hers.
I meant to ask you this earlier when we was talking about Lavinia and her self-portraits, particularly her nude self-portraits. Do you guys take portraits of yourself these days? Do you keep an updated portraits? Nude?
No. Flame, how about you?
No, Flame.
Flame.
That jumped real quick. No. Mm-mm. But yeah, not nude, especially. Every once in a while, like I got a stunt on these folks and just, you know, dress up. But it's been a long time since I did it in the flesh. How about you? Breezy is full on
hedonist. Taking nudes daily,
Breezy got
baby,
a whole library.
Look, if I was fine like that, I would take nudes
every
day too.
I'm saying. I just get a cleavage shot every now and then, call it good, you know.
Look. I'd like to imagine that someday a biographer might be roaming through my papers and they might be getting bored. They might be getting weary because they've been in the archives forever. And then they're going to come upon a very tastefully done nude of me in my prime. And they're going to be like refreshed, replenished, and they're going to be able to keep going.
You're just trying to bless the future.
Yes, which is why I wanted Lavinia's self-portraits to be real, because that's what I'm getting in the archive for.
I do have nudes in my phone, but I don't keep up with them. Like, I don't update them. I just have them there because sometimes people act funny. And so you need a nude so you can move forward. Ooh. But I don't get into it. You know, when people send me nudes, I know now that I'm supposed to send back a reaction. But in real life, no matter how fine you are, like no matter how fat your ass is, no matter how big your dick is, like no matter what, when you send me a nude, I don't care. It does not make me jump in my car any faster or unlock my door any faster. It just doesn't. Like I have no, first of all, I have no reason to believe that's you. Second of all, I have no reason to believe that's you undoctored.
Well,
it's not very 21st century, I know, but I like finding things out. And I know.
You said you need a little mystery.
Yeah. And you know, I'm from a time where we would meet one another everywhere. And now that all, and you know, I would meet guys in the grocery store. I would meet guys at the mall. I would trade numbers. Mm. Do y'all know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like you met people, you traded numbers. Now it's very like, I need to know all of these things before I even meet you. I need to know what your naked body looks like before I even meet you. And so part of the reason I don't care is because I know for a fact that if you can make me laugh, I will forget or not notice or think sexy about your potbelly. But people think that they know what they like, but you don't know what you like if everything in the world before you even meet people tells you, go on the app and X out everybody shorter than this. So if you X out everybody that is shorter than 5'9", then you're not going to meet the guy or the girl or anybody who's 5'8". And the thing is, under another circumstance, you would have met that person who was 5'8". And it ain't like you know the difference by eye between 5'9 and 5'8". And you would have fallen in love. Anyway, I have them, but I don't, you know, take them all the time.
Flame, you've got a poem that you want to read to us?
Emily's fascination with death, also coming in, death is so fly, and the horses are amazing and gorgeous. And I love that she convinces, you know, that she does have these hallucinations or these lucid dreams or these whatever, these visions. And I write about haunting a lot, it turns out. And so when I was asked if there was something related to the show, I was like, maybe, perhaps. Man, Aoife, you've given me so much context too of like Emily's fascination with death and how it's from such a suspended reality. Like she can be fascinated because it's not a visceral reality that she's like actually facing or she is facing it constantly, apparently, but she's so casual about the reality of death and its impact on Sue and everyone around her. And meanwhile, she's very much in her own head. So without further ado, this poem is called Fear, Low Hum. Fear, low hum. Or maybe could you become your own haunting? Live a whole life disquieted and nearly tangible? A question, able spirit, all hollow knocking and hostile home? Could you plague yourself with shadow and vision? Become your own warning sign, the horror of your own real blood pulsing thick and unrestrained?
What an exit. Pulsing thick and unrestrained. Come on.
Thank you. I like questions in a poem.
Me too.
Give the reader something to do later. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
So every episode, Aoife has a question for the poets.
You know, these two sisters and their brother are really, they're reading Keats. So they know the Ode to a Grecian Urn. Beauty is truth. Truth is beauty. Lavinia tries to separate them, but how does beauty or truth drive your work?
I think truth drives my work a lot. I just finished my third book and I was thinking about like epigraphs or for the whole piece. And the one I chose was Tell the Truth and Shame the Devil, which is something my mom used to say all the time. Yeah, I think if poems do nothing else, they ought to tell the truth. And that could be the truth about joy, the truth about love, the truth about our pain or whatever, but whatever you come to the page to say, you know, it needs to be true. What about you, Flame?
I was trying to find the name of this. There's this excerpt that somebody sent me a screenshot of called Nope. And she's basically saying, I do not write about Black and queerness and identity because everything I write is about that. So it really resonated because I want to write beautiful things. They will be true because true, I think, I can't not be true. But also truth is complicated. There's many truths, right? So it's my true, but I'm very much curious about what it means to sit in the beauty of it and to examine, to allow myself to write about beauty and to make beautiful things because I want to and they please me.
Truth always seems to me something that emerges or something that is discovered. You know, I figure out every day more and more about what I really think. You know, sometimes I think I know what I think and then my poems help me figure out what I really think. So I think just as a poet, you know, as a writer in the moment of writing the poem, I'm putting beauty first, even through music. You know, I have this idea that if I can make the right sounds, put together the right words, they will yield truth, but that my responsibility is to make beauty that yields a truth that maybe I did not know I was going to yield through the poem, not through me. You know what I mean? So I think I put beauty first, but only because I want to believe that the beauty does indeed lead to the truth. You know, if anybody's out there listening and they know there's some truth to be said, please say it.
Yes.
You're never going to get the opportunity to be in a situation where it's okay to say it. It's never going to be comfortable. So give up on being comfortable and tell the truth is the best. I don't know what to say about that. Except, you know, part of what's happening, I think at least with Roe, is that there are a lot of people being silent and even more people being disingenuous about their own experience, men in particular being disingenuous, not saying anything about their own experience with abortion. And I think part of the reason why people have to be inauthentic about that is this fear, when in actuality, there are some abortions, some men have paid for that allowed them to be free or more mm-hmm. free than they otherwise would have been, about all kinds of issues of misogyny and race and xenophobia, homophobia, that often what we're dealing with just has to do with people lying mm-hmm. and not telling the truth.
I have to also say, to bring it back to Dickinson, like in episode 5, the way she treated Henry was this with the same blindness that she is angry with George. Like she can say the right thing, but they sure sat up in that kitchen for a good long time before Austin played the hero and was like, let me go get the, you know, like I can do it, you know. But it's sort of the danger that she put Henry in that situation of the Othello play in episode 5 is that same kind of blindness that her father exhibits when it comes to the issue of slavery overall. Is like, well, that's just wrong. And I know it's wrong, but, you know, we're just going to let this play out. I don't know. I think she likes to, I think we like to form ourselves as a hero when we think we can. I think that's natural to want to be the hero that says the thing that stands up, that changes things. Emily's conflict is that she's seeing the ability to possess a body and to tell a body what to do is her experience. And she's like, oh my gosh, I am not free to own a body. It's dangerous. You know, like this is, I don't want to be possessed. And I'm a possessable thing. And, you know, she turns it internally, but that's what we all do, right? That's, you know, secretly, we don't want to be on the bottom rung of whatever it is. And so if it's not me, well, whew, that's one day that I don't have to worry about them coming for me instead.
Flame, don't you think, though, that there is something going on where people, white people, for instance, really have this idea that somehow the more safe everyone who is not white becomes, the more mm-hmm. my safety mm-hmm. becomes precarious. There, that does seem to be a real thinking. But I don't know how to trace that thinking.
Well,
because it doesn't make,
They're the villain. They know that if we're more safe and we feel that we can defend ourselves or we can demand equality or equity or justice or reparations or any of those things, who is there to demand it from but them? And so they are less safe the more safe we are, because then they might have to do something about how they and their and generations before them have been treating people, have been using people. You don't get to make the assumptions that you were born into. If everybody is a little bit more safe, you are less safe. If you're white, if you ascribe to whiteness, that's the thing. You have to put yourself, this is what we ask them to do, right? Put your body in front of mine. Defend me with your life. If you really want to show that you are on my side. At this point, we need white bodies in front of black bodies, in front of the cops, you know, like that. We are asking them to surrender their safety, not just their privilege, surrender their literal safety in order for us to live.
Mm-hmm. That's a whole word, Flame.
I thought about it. I thought about that because I'm like, well, yeah, we're asking you to give up. We're asking you to give up everything that you know and you can rely on, and to share and to reconfigure and to reimagine a world that we've literally never created. We've literally never lived in. Equality? where they do that at? What model what world could we fashion with no model before us, right? It's likely to be bloody.
I think I get with this. I agree with you, Flame. Thank you. Because I think, and even more than equality, I think the big fear is always, and people know the word now, the word equity, right? Mm-hmm. And I think if I was white, I would be really afraid of that word.
Yeah.
Because I think white people really think that, I think the biggest fear is like, oh, I'm going to lose literal land. Mm-hmm. I'm going to have to give my...
And you need to lose literal land.
And they would have to for it to be equitable. Yes. Mm-hmm.
We are at the end of our show, and I want to thank you, Flame, for being here. And thank you for staying on with us a little longer and answering my question.
Yes, it's been such a joy to chat with you.
Thanks for inviting me. This is fun. I love talking shows.
So. I told you we would have fun.
I was like, I don't know what to expect, but this is great. I love learning, Ife. Thank you for that. So many lessons about history and what happened we don't learn in school.
Thanks for listening to The Slave is Gone, where we continue the conversation started by Dickinson and go way beyond.
That's Brian Janae. Their first book is After Jubilee, and they're the author of Blessed Are the Peacemakers, which won the Cave Canem Northwestern University Press Poetry Prize.
That's Jericho Brown. His book, The Tradition, won the 2020 Pulitzer Prize for Poetry. His other books include Please and The New Testament.
Thanks to our special guest on this episode, Amber Flame.
Her second collection of poetry, Apocrypha, is on its way from Red Hen Press in 2023.
Our rogue scholar is Aoife Murray, author of Made as Muse, How Servants Changed Emily Dickinson's Life and Language. Aoife and Lisa Rothman are the show's executive producers.
Matt Martin produces the show. Mary Ann Zahorsky and Celia Bolgatz engineer and edit our audio. Marissa Budlong and Anna Smith are our researchers. And our interns are Lola Anaya and Maggie Olszewski.
Dr. Marilyn Nelson and Dr. Terry Bonhorst Blackhawk are our advisors. And the show receives support from Mass Humanities and the Massachusetts Cultural Council.
Thanks to the many individuals who contributed to make this episode possible. You can give your support with a donation at theslaveisgone.com.
And a final thanks to Catherine Whitcomb and everyone at the Jones Library in Amherst, as well as to the Boutelle Day Poetry Center at Smith College.
We are on Twitter and Instagram. Follow us for bonus materials that take you deeper into Emily Dickinson's life and art, and the world she lived in.
We'll give her the last word. Tell all the truth, but tell it slant. Success in circuit lies too bright for our infirm delight. The truth's superb surprise as lightning to the children eased with explanation kind. The truth must dazzle gradually, or every man be blind.